in the second group. There was a group in before me, and I left the gap and I put my six on. Can we take them out?
Well, that's the Fisk Jubilee Singers in 1909 with John W. Work as the lead tenor. The story of the Fisk Singers goes back over 100 years, as some of you may know. It's one of the more remarkable chapters in the history of African-American music in the United States. Their beginnings in the 1870s and 1880s have been written about quite a bit, but what has not been explored is the remarkable impact that their early recordings had in the early 1900s for Victor and Columbia, not only for fame of the Fisk Jubilee Singers themselves, but for the spiritual, and indeed for African-American, serious African-American music in general. So today, before we hear from the present-day Fisk Jubilee Quartet, we want to take just a little bit of a look at that history and give you a little background about what you're going to hear later. First of all, if you're not familiar with it, the Fisk University was founded in 1865, right after the Civil War. It struggled, it had a great deal of trouble with finances in its early days. It was established by a branch of the Congregational Church in order to provide education, higher education for former slaves, which of course had been unavailable before then, and prepare them for teaching positions in particular. But it was a very, very difficult time at its founding. Administration member and part-time music teacher by the name of George L. White in 1867 came up with the idea of organizing a chorus to perform locally in the Nashville area, a chorus made up of students of Fisk. This performed for a few years to probably unexceptional response. They performed mostly white art music, temperance songs, the white repertoire basically, nevertheless, in 1871, George White had the idea to take them on a tour of the Northeast to help raise funds for the university, which, as I say, was in dire shape. Two things happened in the fall as that tour began. First of all, he noticed that on the program, the occasional spiritual that was sung drew a very strong response, much stronger than the other music they were singing. So like any good showman, he started to increase the amount of repertoire that was devoted to that. The second thing is he came up with the name the Jubilee Singers after the year of Jubilee or Emancipation, a kind of a catchy name which sort of captured what the group was about. By the time they reached New York in the winter of 1871, they were extremely well received. They drew very large groups and very large contributions for the university. In short, the tour was a stunning success and sort of put White's critics to rest of this whole endeavor. By the time they get back in the spring to Fisk University, they'd raised $15,000, a tremendous amount in those days. But that was just the beginning. In the summer of 1872, they were invited to perform at Patrick Gilmore's World Peace Festival in Boston. They figuratively brought down the house. And for the rest of the 1870s, they toured both in the United States and England to extremely good press notices and fame for Fisk University, for themselves, and for the spiritual, which was the core of their repertoire. They eventually raised $150,000, quite a lot of money in the 1870s, which allowed Fisk to build Jubilee Hall, named in their honor, which still stands on the Fisk campus. Well, they disbanded the original quartet, or the original group, I should say, in 1878. There were many imitators in the field by that time, singing spirituals, some of them from other black universities, some of them just entrepreneurs trying to cash in on the vogue for spirituals. And during the 1880s and 1890s, other groups toured, some of them using the Fisk name with permission of the university, but there was not an official Fisk group. In 1898, a black faculty member by the name of John Work II, the one you heard there as the lead tenor on those on that early recording, formed a new student group and began to take it on tour. He was not only a faculty member and the lead tenor and the leader of the quartet, but he was also a folklorist with his brother and published a number of very important books gathering early spiritual material, widening the repertoire of the group. They toured for a number of years in the early 1900s. In 1909, when our story really begins, they signed an exclusive contract with the Victor Talking Machine Company in Camden, New Jersey. This was a historic event because it was the first time that black spirituals had been recorded, actually, by any major label. They were practically unknown in the recorded repertoire. If you scan the catalogs of Victor and Columbia, you won't find any before that. So it was the first time that music of this type had wide distribution. Now, Victor's market, of course, was primarily middle-class white America, so it was an introduction of this music to them. Victor, being the number one record company and having extremely wide dealer network and distribution, spread these recordings far and wide, and they're considered classics. They stayed in the catalog for 15 to 20 years. I have some slides. I don't know if they've found them or not. They seem to have disappeared. They're on their way. Well, later on you'll see what the Fisk singers of this era looked like. But let's hear what they sounded like. Here's another recording from 1909, those historic first sessions. Notice how the voices interweave. The second tenor of the quartet was Reverend James A. Myers. The quartet at this time, by the way, in order to, can I turn this on now? Are we, hello? There they are. From left to right are Alfred King, Reverend Myers, Noah Ryder, and on the right, John Work, the leader and first tenor. Reverend Myers, second from the left there, was the second tenor and a reader. And his specialty in the Fisk concerts was readings of the poems of Paul Laurence Dunbar, probably the preeminent African-American poet of that time. Dunbar had died only 3 years earlier. He gained a great deal of fame and is today considered an absolute pioneer in American poetry and African-American poetry. His most famous works were dialect poems, which were essentially simple kind of human scenes of the pre-war South. And some of these were recorded by Reverend Myers for Victor. They're extraordinary sound documents. They're the first recordings ever of Dunbar's poetry, the first recordings, therefore, of serious black poetry, and some of the first recordings of any kind of serious poetry. Certainly that received any kind of circulation. Myers did four of Dunbar's poems for Victor, the Old Tunes, In the Morning, Banjo Song, and When Melindy Sings. That last one, probably his most famous single poem, is about the best church singer in town. A little bit of When Melindy Sings.
Folks are playing on the banjo, drop their fingers on the string, bless your soul. But you can move them while Melinda's name. She just spreads her mouth and hollers, come to Jesus. Till you hear sinners' trembling steps and voices, timid like a drawing near. Then she turns to rock of ages. Simply to the cross she clings, and you find your tears a second while Melinda sings.
1909. Victor recorded more in 1911 by the quartet and continued to feature them prominently in his catalogs. Sometimes they pictured the quartet or individual members, sometimes they pictured Jubilee Hall. And judging by the caption of this one, the Fisk singers themselves got some mortar and bricks and built Jubilee Hall. I think we know what they meant, however. Later in 1911, Edison recorded the Fisk Jubilee singers for the first time, and only time, actually. At this point, the singers were still led by John A. Work, but the rest of the members were different. And the second tenor at this in these recording sessions in December of 1911 was none other than Roland Hayes, who had been thrown out of Fisk the year before after a dispute with a faculty member. Roland Hayes was only 24 at the time. He had an ambition to become the first successful African-American concert artist, which is a pretty tall order in 1911, and he succeeded spectacularly in years to come, as you may well know. In 1911, these were his first recordings. I can't hear him in this, frankly, but I invite you to listen and see if you can. The lead here is once again John Work. This is Edison, 1911. Well, any of you who have had the joy of trying to transfer a Black Amberol 4-minute cylinder will understand the problems I had with that one. Actually, that's the Blue Amberol reissue of it later on. The original Amberols were only available for 5 months, and they went out of print. And even while Victor and later Columbia were selling huge quantities of Fisk Jubilee Singers recordings, Edison left them on the shelf, another example of Edison's brilliant marketing, I guess. But at any rate, and they're quite rare today, the quartet and the singers continued to, from which the quartet was drawn, continued to tour and perform during the 1912, 1913, 14 period. Columbia became extremely jealous, as you can imagine, at the success Victor was having with these recordings, and even Edison had some cylinders of them. So Columbia issued some spirituals of their own by the extremely obscure Apollo Jubilee Singers in 1912. and some original recordings of Will Marion Cook songs by Cook's own Afro-American folk song singers. But neither of those sold very well, so in 1915, Columbia managed to steal away the Fisk singers from Victor and sign them to its own contract. And they began recording for Columbia, the second biggest label, in 1915. Work was continued as the leader and tenor of the group, and Reverend Myers was back as the second tenor with two other members of the quartet. Columbia introduced these in early 1916, again for their primarily white clientele, and they, for Columbia as well, became bestsellers. They had this line drawing of the group in the Columbia catalog. Here's a Columbia recording from 1915. Obviously a very well-practiced, very professional group. More sessions for Columbia in 1916. Also in 1916, they went back to Edison to do some tests for Diamond Discs. Thomas A. Edison himself, chief music critic and bottle washer at the Edison Company, reviewed the recordings and said, quote, "might take one disc of this trash as novelty," unquote. Thomas A. Edison, one of the great music critics of the 20th century. So later in 1916, they went on to the Star label, which was the first label of the Star Piano Company, and made some now extremely rare vertical cut recordings for Star, which were issued in late 1916, at least four sides. Star later ran the Jeanette label, of course. But they were exclusive in lateral recording to Columbia, so they came back for some more sessions in around 1920. By this time, John Work had retired as the leader of the group, and Reverend Myers had taken over. Reverend Myers getting a little more portly with every picture that you see him in there, as both the lead tenor as well as his trademark recitations. We have some sales information from Columbia, and it turns out in the 15 years or so that Columbia had the Fisk singers in their catalog from 1915 to 1930, they sold almost 1 million copies, which is an awful lot of records in those days. And those records, that sales grew over time, especially strong around 1919, 1920, during the great boom. They were catalog artists, obviously. Some individual titles were over 100,000 copies each. If they sold that many copies on Columbia, they sold even more on Victor, undoubtedly, proven by the number of the frequency with which they turn up today. So together, the two labels are probably over 2 million. That's in a lot of middle-class parlors in the late teens and early 20s. The further sessions that they had for Columbia around 1920 and 1924, to my ears at least, are rather less successful than some of the earlier ones. There's less texture in the harmonization. Of course, the Columbia recording process doesn't help too much either. However, in 1926, they went back one last time, and this time recorded electrically for Columbia, and for this time, for the first time, recorded as a quintet with Mrs. Myers sitting there in the front, Reverend Myers' wife, participating, although not audibly. She was in the background, and they were, of course, by this time called the Fisk Jubilee Singers as opposed to quartet. These are two recordings from 1926, brief excerpts from two recordings. recorded electrically. Notice the intricate multi-part harmony in this and the fact there are five voices, if you can hear Mrs. Myers. Well, Reverend Myers passed away in 1928, whereupon his wife, who was always billed as Mrs. James A. Myers in the front there, took over as leader of the group and led it for the next 20 years. The Fisk Singers by this time were world famous and toured Europe several times, both before and after his death, even recording for Pathé in France under Mrs. Myers in 1929. In fact, here's a picture of them in Paris. Anybody know who that is in front? The corpulent Madame Tetrazzini with her consort at her elbow, and the Fisk Singers behind them. Only in the 1920s, I think, could a picture like that have been taken. They toured for a number of years. In the early 30s, interest in spirituals began to decline, in fact, in many areas of the arts. And in 1932, Fisk attempted to disband the Fisk Jubilee Singers. I say attempted because Mrs. Myers would have none of it and formed a group herself, which performed off campus and became so popular that the university finally recognized it. She was determined to spend the rest of her life, this was her life, spirituals and the singers, and she was enormously determined and enormously successful and continued touring with them through the 30s. They had a radio show in the 30s called Magnolia Blossom, recorded, transcribed right here at WSM in Nashville. And in 1935, they made some more recordings, this time for the Rainbow label of Winona Lake, Indiana, although the recordings were made in Chicago. This is a very obscure label, very, very obscure, as a matter of fact. Apparently an offshoot of the Rainbow label of the 20s, run by Rhoda Heaver. They recorded a number of titles, and as you'll hear, by this time they were a double quartet and primarily sounding like a male chorus. This was the approximate lineup as the time they made the 1935 sessions for Rainbow, of which we'll hear two short excerpts.
Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, out of his mouth came fire and smoke. Looked all around me, things looked so fine, and I asked my Lord if all was mine. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I'm afraid. Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I'm afraid. Jordan River, body, but not the soul. Tank but the one train on this track runs to heaven and runs right back. Every time I feel a feeling moving in my heart, I'm afraid. Every time I feel a feeling moving in my heart, I'm afraid. Every time.
No sound effects, that's right. You know that record. Mrs. Myers kept the group together and kept it touring through the 30s and the 40s, but finally, evidently, politics at Fisk caught up with her in the late 40s, and she left the group, shall we say, in 1947. But never to be kept down, she formed another group under her own leadership, which toured in the 50s and even recorded for several labels. Meanwhile, the official Fisk Jubilee Singers became a student group again, under the chair of the music department, who was none other than Professor John W. Work III, the son of the tenor that we heard earlier. And they made three LPs in the 50s for Folkways, Harmony, and the Word label, a gospel label. Work retired in 1957 and was succeeded by Matthew W. Kennedy, who was the leader for almost 30 years after that. By this time, it was a chorus much larger and dominated by female voices, which is an interesting shift from the male domination of the early 1900s. This is an excerpt from one of those LPs that I mentioned, the Folkways LP from 1955. Rockin' Jerusalem.
Oh, Mary, ring them bells, darling.
summarize then, the Fisk Jubilee Singers had an enormous impact, particularly in the first quarter of the 20th century via their recordings for Victor and Columbia, sold millions of them. And just as the original Fisk Jubilee Singers in the 19th century had brought the spiritual to America and brought it to all levels of society, these recordings brought the actual sound of the Fisk Jubilee Singers both to homes across America then and to us. That's our little background on the Fisk Jubilee Singers. Do we have time for a couple of comments from Doug Suroff? Doug Suroff is probably the leading biographer of the group, working on a book on them, eagerly awaited. He lives in this area, and he's agreed to say a few words to us.
I haven't prepared it.
We need to record.
Okay, sorry. I haven't prepared a paper, but I appreciate Tim inviting me up to say a couple words. There was three items I thought I might bring to your attention. First, I'd like to acknowledge the excellent work and the important work that Tim has done on discographies of early African American recording artists, and particularly the Fisk Jubilee Singers. We should be aware that this is an area that has been ignored for a very long period of time. The standard discography, Godrich and Dixon's Blues and Gospel Records, went through the first three editions claiming that this group was of no real interest to students of African American music, which is not only mistaken, but it's vaguely slanderous. It just shows a complete lack of appreciation. There has been but the new edition of Godrich and Dixon's Blues and Gospel Records, which is due out momentarily, does include the Fisk Jubilee Singers discography and other spiritual singing group, university spiritual singing groups as well. And I wanted to bring this to your attention. Document Records, the indomitable Document Records, Johnny Parth in Austria, has very recently issued a three-volume set, which is three of what will be a four-volume set of the complete early recordings of the Fisk Jubilee Singers. These make extremely eye-opening listening. Listening to a few hours of this group, you get some more idea of what their intention was and how well they achieved it. These will be available, I suppose, in Tower with the other document product. And if you have no Tower or don't know how to obtain document, you might talk to Chris Strachwitz, who distributes document product in the United States. I also wanted to, Tim had mentioned about, talked quite a bit about Professor John Work too. Something that is not necessarily well known even here in Nashville about Professor Work is that he directed an annual spring concert for the governor of Tennessee and the state legislature at the Ryman Auditorium annually from 1909 to 1923. This was very popular at the time and well known at the time he was doing it, but now it seems to have been completely forgotten. One of the reasons for raising this point is the fact that the Fisk Jubilee Singers, marking their 125th anniversary this year, will be giving a special concert at the Ryman Auditorium on Monday, May the 6th, this coming Monday. The program includes a chorus of 40 former Fisk Jubilee Singers, along with the current Fisk Jubilee Singers group, the Fairfield Four, and the Nashville Bluegrass Band. So if you're in town, that's something worth checking out. And thank you for your time and attention.
Okay, is this on?
No.
We need to change some things around up here, but while we're doing that, why don't we open the floor to questions for Tim or Doug?
Yes.
Doug?
Where did Doug go?
He sang at the Ryman Auditorium, and it should be understood that the Ryman Auditorium
Yes. Yes, Fred.
I think there may be more than one of us in the crowd here that remember from your own high school days that Fred Waring used to publish through his organization and others, particularly Steal Away and Ezekiel Saw the Wheel. Now, I happen to have sung with Fred Waring in the All Nassau County Chorus in 1940-41 on Long Island. And Fred did both of those things. And of course, it was thrilling not only to have your high school director that goes through it, but to have this inspirational genius conducting you, and a memorable experience for the whole my whole life. I'm sure some of you must have sung this music in your high school choruses. Am I wrong about that? Is there anybody else that did sing? There's one. Anybody else that had that? There's another. I'm sure. There we go. So we all owe a debt of gratitude to the Fisk Jubilee Singers because it affected our lives.
Yes. Sir.
Was there any relationship between the Fisk Jubilee Singers and the Dinwiddie group that was singing previous to them?
No, the Dinwiddie group was a group based out of Virginia for a small black college there, which, as you know, recorded for Victor in 1901, I believe. The Fisk Singers by that time were a world-famous group. The Dinwiddie was unheard of at that point, and afterwards, actually. So there was not a connection between them that I'm aware of, other than the fact of the kinds of colleges they represented or kinds of material. The Dinwiddie Singers, incidentally, did not record, I think they recorded one or two spiritual numbers, and the rest were more entertainment numbers, shall we say. They appeared in vaudeville.
There
yes, correct.
Black groups recorded on brown wax in the 1890s, correct?
Yeah, there were vaudeville touring groups, such as the Unique Quartet and the Standard Quartet, that recorded on cylinders during the 1890s. I'll have those in my work too. In fact, I talked about those at a arts conference some years ago. They were popular entertaining groups, and a lot of their stuff was black songs mocking blacks of the time. They did, I believe, the Standard and the Dinwiddie did do one sort of semi-spiritual sort of in this vogue, but it certainly wasn't their core repertoire. Also, their recordings, of course, disappeared almost as soon as they came out. The thing about the Fisk Singers is they not only stayed in the catalog, but they had enormous distribution.
What was the interaction between the Fisks and the Barbershop Quartet movement at the same period?
Doug, do you want to tackle that? Your partner wrote an article about that, Lynn Abbott.
Now, Barbershop is a loaded term.
Sales of these records may have been in part models for some of the developments in the barbershop community.
That's an interesting theory. I don't have any.
Was there anything analogous? Obviously, there was stuff from the White Quartet that recorded on an acoustic label. And I'm just wondering whether this is part of a cosmos or whether these were diverse and non-touching.
Yeah, I don't know of a connection between barbershops. Certainly these recordings, I think, were influential in passing this music far deeper into the repertoire than it had been even through the work of the Fisks years before. In the 20s, everybody, including Madame Melba, recorded spirituals and pop artists. And Vincent Lopez and his orchestra made a foxtrot medley of spirituals at one point, which is wonderful to dance to. So I think the Fisk Singers and their enormous popularity on record in the teens probably led to that, however. Yeah.
You run across these recordings as well on Columbia Personal Label, the P series. How are those distinct from the regular issues? Why were those even recorded?
Fisk Singers P series?
So.
I would like to see them. I would like to see them if there are any. I don't know those. That's a different group, yeah.
So they didn't record any personal recordings?
Not that I'm aware of, no. No.
Roland Hayes did.
Yes, Roland Hayes had quite an active, he started almost his own little label on the Columbia Personal side in 1917, but that's another story for another time. It's a good question, by the way, who bought these records, whites or blacks? My thesis is it was primarily sold to middle-class whites because that was the audience that Victor and Columbia sold to, and their copy and their supplements and catalogs are very distinctly aimed in that direction. Not until the 20s, when the blues revolution and so forth happened, did phonographs really spread among black America.
I picked up a collection of records from a family, and basically that's what it was, in white middle-class folks, and there were some of those records in, just like Corel read them for at least once.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, by the way, when the I didn't mention this, when the first Victors came out by the Fisk Jubilee Singers, in order to assure people that this was the real thing, because there were imitators out there, they printed the names of the members of the quartet on the label, something, if you know records of that period, is extremely unusual. And they continued to say Work and Myers and Ryder and so forth right on the record of the label so that you'd know that they had the real thing. So obviously the Fisk Singers themselves were the stars here in addition to the music.
We should start.
Okay. I should mention that the last time the Fisk Jubilee Singers made a cylinder recording was in 1911. So we've had a bit of a hiatus here in their cylinder recording career, and it's about time to rectify that, wouldn't you say?
So you're going to do the announcements?
Sure, if you tell me what to announce.
Okay. There we go. I think they're going to do some test recording first.
Just tell me what you want.
Okay. Okay, so the group here, come on up.